From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Nothing characterizes Las Vegas more than gambling. So while we were in Las Vegas broadcasting live over the internet, as well as to some 60,000 attendees of the NetWorld plus Interop conference, we thought we might take a look at what technology has done for gambling. Howard Schwartz is the marketing director for the Gambler's Book Club and Bookshop. It carries the largest collection of materials on gambling available. And it's used by such diverse clientele as federal government agencies, movie production companies, novice gamblers from around the world, and of course the professionals. We'll also speak with Jim Bale, president of SportsStat. Jim has written 7 books on thoroughbred horse racing, and his business provides information and analysis on over 1,000 thoroughbreds throughout the United States. We'll talk to him about how simulcasting has changed the game of betting the horses. For years, gambling in Las Vegas has seemed the same to me. The blackjack tables, slot machines, poker tables, roulette and craps. But just a few years ago, there was a definite shift. Suddenly, the machines had computer interfaces, and there were huge TV screens everywhere with a new emphasis on sports. I asked my guests just what has happened.
High-tech is the shape of the future, and I think that many of the casinos have found that it is easier to service a group of machines than to have technicians repairing parts, so your computer chips and the shape of things to come for the future is here. We're going to see more electronic keno, everything electronic. I just hope they don't lose the personal touch altogether. People need people to some degree. Robbie the robot will not serve the needs on an inter-social relationships.
Well, one of the things I was thinking about is, like, you know, the old slot machines, you could hear the inside, ka-chunk, 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 and all that. But now you go in and like, you play blackjack, and, I mean, it's just not as viscerally, you know, it's just not satisfying, you know?
It's the golden days of blackjack are over. Ken Houston, who was one of the great computer whizzes of all time, by the way, he made more money with computers than he did with blackjack. He probably made $2 million in blackjack and blew as much in other areas. He died in 1987. He made his money working for the Arab countries, doing their accounting work, by the way. I believe it was Kuwait or Abu Dhabi or somewhere like that. But those days you could bet against a one deck or two decks. Now the guys have gotten so good. There are probably people out there right now, I don't know in this casino or not, but around the world with computers in their shorts. Believe it or not, there are accounting devices, and we know people who have been arrested, and it's illegal in some certain areas, and they're doing it a little more overseas, but they're sweeping electronically. In fact, we've got some books on the subject of how people have tried to beat roulette using a computer. Fascinating. There were like 17 physics professors from Silicon Valley, the Bass crew, Thomas Bass, and Eudaimonic Pi, where they actually came into our store in 1975, read everything they could find on roulette, and developed a computer chip that worked and it fit into a belt into their shoe. It went down there, and they were timing. Ed Thorpe actually came up with this, the father of blackjack, came up with it early, but this is highly sophisticated, judging the rotation of the wheel and the velocity of the ball and so on, and it's called clocking the wheel. You're either looking for a defective wheel or you're looking for something
that changes the even.
Well, you
were
betting
stuff.
Certain numbers. Now, all they had to do is wait to the last second and bet those that section. They would clock the wheel. It would say a certain section would fall into that wheel more than any other. But a little impulse would follow from the guy's toes up to his thigh and suddenly tell him, bet, that's it. All right, put your money down. They needed a team of people to pop those chips down at the very last second.
Howard, they actually used their toes for data entry, didn't they?
Yes.
I know on the blackjack systems they did.
What?
Yeah, they punched in the whatever cards had been played, or I don't know what the roulette, whether it was red, black, or what.
They punched in
The data cards that have been played through the deck with their toes. Right, and then the computer somehow, I don't know, Howard, how that would signal them that it was a positive deck or a negative deck.
Well, they had programmed it in some way, and these items were strapped to their body and to their shoes, and actually some people were using TV cameras, creepy peepees, right up the fly, shooting the... It's true. There was a truck out in the parking lot, and they would see the card. Somebody in the truck would say to them, okay, the dealer's got an ace 10 or something, like, or a 6-7 or whatever it might be. And they were caught accidentally there. But there are people, believe me, there are people doing things out there right now.
There's one particular, maybe I shouldn't bring this up right now, but there's one particular, we understand that people have now learned a way of grinding up a computer chip, liquefying it, and attaching to a card in some way, marking or daubing the cards. Well, as they come off the deck, some device they're wearing on their body gives them a little impulse and tells them if it's a 5 or a 10, which can be a tremendous advantage. The players sometimes deviously are way ahead of management.
Now, is this professional?
These are professionals, yes. When there's money involved, they'll find a cure for cancer or find a short way to Mars.
Now, let me ask you this. The Gambler's Bookshop and the Gambler's Book Club, are those two different things or the same thing?
30 years ago, 1964, this is our 30th anniversary, John Luckman, who founded the store, wanted a place where gamblers could go to feel comfortable, to discuss and argue and exchange information. So he used the word club, the Gambler's Book Club. Anybody who's ever shot a game of craps or flipped baseball cards or played jacks, or even if you have insurance, you're a member of the club because you're a risk taker. But as the years went on and things like the Doubleday Book Club were formed and so on, people
legit
got a little confused.
Stuff,
so we made the transition over to Gambler's Book Shop because we had people coming into the store saying, okay, where's the slots? Can I get a drink? They thought we were a little bar sometimes. You hear club.
Yeah.
This is a small casino. So now we stick with the name Gambler's Book Shop, but we are still known by the original customers as Gambler's Book Club, a.k.a. also known as.
So the in-group knows it's the Gambler's Book Club.
Yes, I think most people know. We have to explain sometimes. We put it in parenthesis.
How many books are in the Gambler's Book Club?
We've got 1,000 different new titles and 32 subsections of gambling. That's psychology, sociology, roulette, blackjack, horse racing, whatever it might be, poker.
There's 1,000 titles. 1,000 new titles.
1,000 new books.
Just on gambling.
Just on gambling, and another 5,000 used books, plus computer software for any form of gambling, to test your system, to train yourself, to improve your skills, or to learn the game, plus videotapes. And our new catalog is due out in about 6 weeks, and I've got another 125 new books that have come out in the past 4 months.
So a lot of your customers aren't even here. They go by the catalog.
They're all around the country, all around the world. We've got customers in every country, every state. If they're playing or they know the word risk, they're gambling. And the smart person reads the book before they play. I'll give you an example.
Can't afford it
afterwards. There was a guy in Texas called us. And he says, and I'll try to do it with my best Texas accent, with this Brooklyn sound. He says, yeah, you people got any books on Hold'em? I said, yes, we've got about
Hold'em?
Hold'em poker, the most popular form of poker in existence today. It's outstripped seven-card stud about 5 years ago. This man had lost $100,000 in Hold'em and had never read a book in his life. But some of his fellow players had so much pity on him, I guess, or somebody told him that we did have books on Hold'em. He did buy, he says, what have you got? And I gave him all the titles we had, and he bought them all. Now, I never heard from him again, but I think he became a slower loser or a winner. But you must read before you play. That's my advice. Our motto might be called moderation and education. Play moderately. It's adult education. Read before you play, know about the rules of all the games before you sit down. Know as much about the game you play as the people who are running it.
So what would you say, if you don't know anything, you're kind of, you know, you're just sort of at their mercy. But if you do know, I mean, how good can it get?
I'll give you an example. Video poker right now is probably the most addictive form of gambling in the country. Very popular. Now, if you've read no book at all, nothing at all, You may be on your sixth or seventh roll of quarters or dollars, just pouring it in, not knowing what you're doing. You're hoping to get lucky. You have no strategy. You don't know what cards to hold. You're throwing away the good cards. You don't know what the positive expectation situations are, whatever. However, if you've read a book, you probably, instead of being eight or nine rolls of coins down, maybe only two or three rolls of coins down. I'm not saying you're going to become a winner, but your losses are going to be slowed down by a correct strategy. That's why it's important to know the basic strategy in blackjack. There are people who might as well mail their wallets in to the casinos and save themselves the trip. They are playing. You watch them in the supermarkets. They go in there for a loaf of bread. It costs them $55 by the time they left for that. That's expensive bread. So the books do help. We know because our customers have told us. I'll give you one of the most bizarre situations on a book. This is just outlandish. What the odds on this are, I don't know. Next door to the store are some accountants. Some people were waiting for the accountant's office to open. He hadn't opened yet. So they came in and bought a $1 book on Keno. Now, on the cover of the Keno book, or inside this one, there was an example of how to fill out a Keno ticket. Well, they went down to the casino, and they filled out the ticket exactly the way the book told them to do it, because they thought that was the only way to fill out the ticket. They won $111,000, something like that, because it was a progressive jackpot. And
They just got it, right?
They actually called us and told us that this happened. I mean, these things happen. I mean, if you shoot at the sky long enough, a duck is going to fly by. That happened. You know, just don't run out of ammunition. But the idea is to pre-plan on whatever you're doing, whether you bet the horses or casino games or poker. Get into a game where you find an edge, where at least three or four players are worse than you are. You've read a book. A book gives you information, gives you some confidence, some idea of what a bad bet is, what a good bet is. And it lowers your loss rate.
So then luck can take over.
Luck is part of it. You must get the cards in poker or blackjack to eventually win. I mean, you need some luck, but skill and luck. Poker is considered a game of skill with some luck. It's a matter of what the ratio is according to the situation.
Well, you know, it's amazing to me when I think of all these books. I mean, Jim, you're a young guy. You wrote 7 books on thoroughbred racing. After two, what was there left to say?
Well, we cover a different topic in each one. And what they are basically is more statistical analysis or reports more than books. We take a group of 10,000 thoroughbred racehorses each month, and now we're going every other month. And we look for patterns that can help handicappers, and we look for what we call positive ROIs, return on investments. And if a player's real sharp today, thoroughbred racing is one of the few games that actually can be beaten, and there are certain people that can make 10 to 20% on their money.
So, not just the books alone, but you all, Sports Stats, just produce a lot of these statistical reports on the horses that are out there.
Right. Technology allows us to do this. 10 years ago, I couldn't run the company that I run today because the download services were not available, and you can just get any kind of data on thoroughbred racing today right over the phone lines. And the computers also 10 years ago were not powerful enough to do it, or at least the ones that were affordable were not powerful enough to do it. So it's been a huge change, and it's really allowed me to open a company that's really, really doing well right now.
Now, where are the horses? I mean,
not in Las Vegas, Leah. That's for sure.
There's none in Las Vegas.
Why I'm here in particular?
Yeah, why are you in Las Vegas? There are no horses here.
It's one of the few places where you can play 10 tracks and get treated like a human being. Also, I mean, once you've played here, I could never go back and go to Belmont or Aqueduct or Santa Anita and sit through, you know, a half-hour wait in between races and be treated rudely. And I mean, they just treat you like a king here. Everything is free if you're gambling, you know, your meals and beverages, and there's a silver coffee service going around, and it's just a fantastic place to play horses.
Now, where are the horses? I mean, how many different tracks are there that you can just sit in one spot and watch?
If you go about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you can see about 7 live tracks going on at the same time.
Now, do you watch the horses from here? Or do you have people at the track?
I actually like the Hilton very much. The super, what they call a super book here, is my favorite book.
That's
in town.
That's the one with all the screens.
It's huge, right? I think they're 10 or 12 feet big, and you can literally see everything. It's like being
They got 30 screens all going at once.
Yes.
So like going to the Good Guys and buying a TV, but it's all the same screen. Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's all the different ones.
It's actually, when people first come, they get a little bit intimidated because they say, oh my God, it's too much action. I can't take it. But after you're here a little while and you set your parameters and you say, you know, what you learn to do is you can zero in on the profitable situations. If you don't like to play grass races, you don't play grass races because there's so much selection here. You have 100 races a day. You can just play sprints if you want, or just play roots.
You know, I went over there beforehand and researched. I went to the Hilton Sportsbook, you know, and looked around, and I was looking at I looked at the screen and had this thing roll by, but because the Kentucky Derby's coming up, you know, and it said 1.5 mile, 3 YO. Is it 3-year-olds?
Yes.
Okay, so it tells you about that. Purse, $500,000. Now, it's like the winner get that, or does everybody split that? What's
The purse of $500,000 goes 60% to the winner, and then it breaks down from there, like 20% to the second horse, 15 and 10. It goes down to fourth or fifth position, depending on the state.
Now, is that important to a bettor?
No, not really, except that that's the biggest race of the year, the Kentucky Derby, which is going on this Saturday.
Now it says Quinella wagering only.
Quinellas are your bet, right. It's harder bet to win, but of course the payoff is much better. You're trying to pick the horse that runs first and second on the same ticket, and they can run in either order.
In either order, so you got to pick two horses.
Right. If you pick the one and the two, and they run 1-2, you win. If they run 2-1, you win.
Okay. Now it said Holy Bull is listed at 8-5.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
That means that right now. Well, 8-5 means for every $5 you bet, you will win 8 or get back 13, whichever way you want to look at it.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the morning line expert's opinion of what the odds will be. The actual, in horse racing, you play against the public. The odds are not fixed. And if $10 million is bet on Holy Bull and only $1 million is bet on everybody else, he's going to be a very short price. So the actual money that's bet creates, it's called parimutuel system, actually creates the actual line that you're going to get paid off on. The 8-5 is just somebody's estimate of what he thinks Holy Bull will be. I think it'll be actually much shorter. But
really? Now, who do you think is going to win?
It's one of the most interesting derbies in a long time because I think there's a horse that Holy Bull can't lose, but he doesn't have what they call dosage or breeding. He's bred to be a sprinter, which means it's a short race. And the Kentucky Derby is the first mile and a quarter race for three-year-olds, and it's a true test of stamina. And the breeding experts are against the speed experts, and it's really, really fascinating. It's going to come down to a really interesting race.
Well, I'm going to bet on Smilin' Singin' Sam. I go by the names. You know,
you should read one of Howard's books first.
I should take the money from the bet and go to your store, bookshop, and buy a book on thoroughbred racing.
Well, if you want to have some fun, I think a book would help. And for the people out here or people listening, we have the perfect book for those people who are interested in the combination of computers and handicapping. This was written by Dr. James Quinn, High-Tech Handicapping in the Information Age, an information management approach to thoroughbred. All you need to know about hardware and software to set up your own computer programs and get the most out of your computer. The head of Adelphi University's statistics department, Dr. William Quirin, Q-U-I-R-I-N, back in 1978, wrote a magnificent book on computer called Winning at the Racetrack. And this is my favorite book because he analyzed all those factors. This is an extension of this gentleman's book in some way because he was the breakthrough. What significance do all these factors have? A new jockey, a lower odds, a class drop, a distance drop, a change from turf to dirt, what is the effect of breeding, and so on. It's one of the most fascinating things that people have been involved in since the time of the Revolutionary War, probably. There are so many factors, so many things changing, and it is such an intellectual challenge in some ways. Now, very few people can do this consistently. It's supposed to be fun. It is.
Oh.
I would say if we gave everybody at the Hilton $1,000 to bet, and at the end of the week, you must bet at minimum of something. At the end of the week, we'd come back. Out of the 1,000 people, we would find, I think, you might disagree with me, 30 people that have more than the 1,000, and everybody else would claim they're even. Somebody's nose would be growing like Pinocchio.
Most of them lose their money.
Most of them will have no money management skills or have no systematic approach to this. Some might get lucky and hit a trifecta or an exotic bet. That's trifecta is first, second, and third in exact order.
But I think it's supposed to be fun. I think everybody likes that, a little adrenaline high. They like to have their heart beating. I remember I played in a poker tournament in 1982. I'd read a book the night before on Hold'em Poker. I did exactly what the book told me to do. I was in there against 82 players, and I finished second in the tournament. I didn't win because I didn't know what to do in a head-up. I just shoved all my chips in at the end on the last hand, the last card. It was a good move, but I finished second. But my heart was beating so fast. And see, I shoved in $150,000 worth of play chips. These are play chips. But see, my mind and heart said they're play chips, but my hand said that's money. I was shaking so badly, I knocked all the chips over every time I shoved them. And really, I don't think you can fool your body sometimes. And your heart is pumping, so I'm on a hot streak, I'm going to win. And that's what people want. Now, after a while, you're supposed to get away from that and go home. You're not supposed to be on the Ferris wheel at Disneyland for three straight days. That's my correlation to this. The body cannot take that kind of stress for that period of time. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be fun, and then you go back to life. Uh-huh. See, the gambling is not supposed to be a life. You're looking at the other end of the periscope or the telescope, uh-huh. In a sense. So that's what I think it is. I think people like that little bit of excitement, and then they're supposed to calm down, go eat, sleep, and find out, smell the roses.
Yeah, that's right. You're listening to Tech Nation Live from Las Vegas, Nevada, and the 1994 NetWorld plus Interrupt Conference. I'm Moira Genna, and my guests today are Howard Schwartz, Marketing Director for the Gamblers Book Club, and Jim Bale from SportsStat. Now, Howard, I saw one of the categories in your bookstore was Mafia. It's a whole section?
Well, you actually saw a section called Biography and History. Organized crime historically has always been close to where loose money was. In gambling, before it was legalized anywhere else and only legal in Nevada, people have been gambling from the earliest days of the Bible. But wherever there's money, there's somebody who's broke, and somebody who's going to loan shark, or somebody who's going to lend some, or somebody who's going to say, hey, I'll give you some protection so the game's not broken into and you're not robbed. So organized crime has always been there. This town is cleaner than ever before. I'm not saying it's completely clean, because that would be hypocritical to say that. But if you'll notice, major corporations have moved in to take over and have moved the old boys out. I'm not saying there aren't a few holes still left in the system, but big business has said, a lucrative business, makes a lot of money, let us take over. And so they have, through their accounting, through the computerization, through tracking the money and the players and so on, organized crime it continues to try to make some inroads into other areas of the country, whether they're leasing or selling equipment, or they have some people move in who are cheating, whether there is some hanky-panky going on one way or another, but it's there. I think that most states have learned how to identify the high-profile people, those who are connected, and they've probably kept it as clean as they can. But it's always the fear that the industry will be tainted again with the hand.
Sure. Now, I know that when I was amazed at some of the people who come and get books at your bookshop, like the FBI, the Nevada Gaming Board. I mean, don't they know the games? I mean,
have a lot of people who have made lateral transition in from accounting, from MBAs from Harvard. These are Mr. Clean types, Mr. Innocent. They're now put in a position of authority where they came from, say, a hotel chain that never had any gambling. All of a sudden, they're into a gambling atmosphere. So they've got to know, what are the correct accounting procedures, management, marketing procedures? How do I talk to these people? What does that term mean? How have people done some hanky-panky in the past? What am I alert for? How do I help the hotel continue to make profits and management decisions? And so these people will buy books to, quote, load up, much like a psychic would load up in the old days of a town. They load up very quickly, and they become consultants, or they become advisors, or they become part of management of a big corporation. I'll give you an example. The Harrah Corporation has been training thousands of people out of Memphis, Tennessee, and other places because they're opening up casinos in Mississippi, Colorado, South Dakota, Louisiana, wherever it might be. And so you need a crash course in what you should know, and they buy books. That's the best way to learn. Uh-huh. It's books or seminars or hope to make it like they did in the old days. He was a busboy in 1936. He's a casino owner in 1986. It's a long haul, you know, unless you marry into it or juiced in.
Right. Now let me ask you, the software, I mean, do you sell software?
We sell software. We got into it about 5 years ago. We're very reluctant to get into it, but one of our people who was sharper than I am in this area knew what the customers were asking for. I want to learn how to play blackjack. I want to test my blackjack system. I want to learn video poker. I want to learn hold'em poker. Which hands are the best? Which hands have the most value? I want to remove my inhibitions at the tables. I want to be prepared and confident. So these are the things that the software does. Some of them have a lot of bells and gongs, and the most expensive software we sell is $300, and the least expensive, I think, is
$6. $6 for $6.
Yes, just get your tootsies wet on a few items right there. But it's software. And we're seeing a lot of overlap now. A lot of people have not done what you call a survey of literature, so they think their software is the first breakthrough material out there. Little do they know, for instance, the guy who invents a candy bar, that Hershey's has been alive for many years. So some of these people, I have to say to them, can you do something nobody else is doing? So the graphics and the color and I don't know all the terms. I'm going to tell you that sitting here right now is the most computer illiterate person in the universe. I mean, RAM, DOS, DOS, version 1, high density. It's like a Hungarian menu to me. But I can deal with the customers and tell them, here's a description provided by the vendor. Here's what it does. I'll even give you his phone number. You can call him at 3 in the morning, ask him anything you want. But here's all I have on that. So before you buy it, ask him what it does.
But you can find this in the catalog, though.
You can find it in our catalog, because I asked the vendor to give me a very, very good description of the software and talk like a human being. This is what it does. This is what it doesn't do. And so I advise anybody buying software for computers or any form, whether it be horse racing or poker or casino games, to really know what they want before they buy, because obviously there's no returns once you get it.
Open the package.
Yes.
Now, how many of the books do you actually read, Howard?
I read almost every book that comes in. I wouldn't say I read. I'm a very fast reader. I can read 1,500 words a minute. I skim and scan. I was a reading instructor. I could read when I was about 4 years old, and I'm very lucky that way. I am very alert to information that's inaccurate or been repetitive or really is out of line, great promises of riches and so on. If I think a book stinks because of the price or or it's been plagiarized or there's nothing new in there, I pretty well will reject the book for those reasons. But if there's something innovative, something new, a fresh view of something that hasn't been illuminated before, then we'll carry it, because I know the customers. I've been able, in 14 years, to get into the players' minds. I know what they're asking for. I know what the pattern is. For instance, a great area now of growth is sports betting. Sports betting is probably the hottest area for computer software in the country. Now, we're coming up on the football season soon. We're in the third of the way through the baseball season. Basketball is in its final stages. We do see hockey software for the first time. I would imagine we're going to see something on soccer for the next month or two. I don't know. I don't see anything out there. By the way, anybody listening, can I say this over the air? That anybody listening who has some computer software for a bettor to have fun or to keep records or to crunch statistics or to come up with what, you know, a good wager, a good investment, can contact me at the Gambler's Book Shop or Gambler's Book Club in Las Vegas. And we're available through the an 800 information number. And
just call 800 information and you can find it.
Gambler's Book Shop or Gambler's Book Club in Las Vegas, Nevada. Club or shop. And they'll give you an 800 number, and you can just contact me, and I'll be glad to look at it. We've given some authors who only had 20 copies of a book a chance to sell the book. In fact, many of the people, we've published 122 books, by the way, since 1964.
Yourself.
Yes. And many people who have gotten a break with us have gone on to major publishers and have been rediscovered by other companies. And we, you know, it's not like you're at our mercy.
If we give you a chance and you want to go someplace else, that's fine. This is a free world.
Now, Jim, let me ask you, do you sell the raw statistics, or are you talking about your analysis, the SportsStats, your analysis of what's coming in?
It's actually my analysis. We do what we call queries on the data, and then we present them in little charts. And each analysis has usually about 60 different charts that we think. We generate hundreds, and we only print the ones we think are relevant or interesting to the people. But I have to say about Howard's store is, you know, if you're used to your store at home, you go in and there's a gambling section and might be half of a wall and stuff. But Howard's store, every topic he's spoken about, he has almost a complete wall or more on. I mean, we were talking about cons and things before. I noticed a book was waiting for Howard to come up here called The Policeman's Guide to Carnival Games.
Ooh.
Okay, I mean, so he's got an entire section of con artists. Serious statistics, serious accounting, serious casino management, horse racing, dice. And the nicest thing at all for me, when I remember years ago when I first came to the store, is if you walk in and the staff has been with them for years, they'll say to you, oh, what are you looking for? And I say, well, I'm looking for a blackjack book. They've got an expert in that store on each different topic. And
we've got an ex-bookmaker in the store. We've got a blackjack counter. We've got a professional horse racing handicapper. These people are serious about this. And in fact, the owner of the store, Mrs. Luckman, is an expert on the antique books, the books that are 30, 40, 50, or even 100 years old. She knows the prices.
On gambling.
On gambling. And in fact, we are called by movie studios sometimes to help out. For instance, Jeff Bridges will be making a movie on Wild Bill Hickok, and they want to know the type of playing cards, what kind of a game were they playing then, what kind of guns were they using, what kind of a card table, and so on. Now, Nick Pileggi, who wrote Goodfellas and Wise Guys, is going to make a $25 million movie here called Casino. And they needed the architecture of what Las Vegas was like in the 1970s. And this will be a very interesting movie. So they needed books to develop their sets. Kevin Costner's people call from New Mexico. They needed to know how to play the game of Faro so they could have that Faro scene accurate in the movie. So we helped them with this. We're now mentioned in about 20 different books. And this is what's helped us become a very unique bookstore, because we do more than just sell books. I'm a librarian for gamblers. No matter what you call me, that's what I am. If I were an expert on gambling, I wouldn't be sitting here right now. I'd be in my Rolls Royce with six blondes and 8 pastrami sandwiches. I mean, what else is there in life?
I don't know. That's good. Now, Jim, I mean, I'm looking at you, and this is radio, and it's like, how old are you?
41.
Well, you're young looking, 41.
That's the second time you said that, and the second time I appreciated it.
And it's like, how could you have spent that much time betting on horse racing and knowing horse? I mean, how did you get into it, and how long did it take you before you, say, wrote your first book?
Oh, well, I am from New York State, like Howard's from Brooklyn, in a small town called near Saratoga called Glens Falls, and I got hooked at Saratoga, which is just the nicest meeting of thoroughbreds there is. And went to school in New York for 20 years, and that's where I really fell into it full-time, because the racing there is year-round. And it just slowly developed. College became less and less interesting, and horse racing became more and more interesting. And
so you were going to the races during college?
Oh, with my scholarship money. I'm sorry, New York State.
You were betting your scholarship money.
In my early 20s, I was compulsive. I was compulsive for several years. I had a real problem with it for several years. And then didn't do any therapy or anything, and I'm not recommending this to people, but just somehow I just got away from it and got control of myself. And
so do you bet now?
Occasionally. The company, unfortunately, takes a lot of my time, and I don't get out as much as I'd like to, but I can think of nothing better than just sitting in a sports book all day and taking my choice of the 100 races that are going.
Really?
Yeah, I love it.
You did. How about you, Howard? You bet?
I'm a future bettor. It's probably one of the worst bets.
Fuji?
No, not Fuji.
Fuji?
No, I don't bet on cameras or film. It's future, F-U-T-U-R-E. Now, for instance, I bet on Holy Bull, and I bet on Valiant Nature. These
the
are
Derby.
Two horses. I bet them 3 months ago, and I got very good odds on it. Now, if that horse had died or been scratched, or said, oops, I'm not running today, I would not get a dime. But I've got both horses at better than 10 to 1. I didn't bet that much, but I have a better odds than the 2 to 1 you're going to get, or 8 to 5 Derby day. So I took my chances. I bet my football during the baseball season. For instance, I will bet, let's say, the New York Giants or the New York Jets, and I can get them at 20 to 30 to 1. I'm just throwing that out, not as being a good bet. But I take my chances. I like to bet the beginning of the year, based on all the research I do, and if they win at the end of the season, I present my ticket and they give me my money. I cannot bet every day. I don't have the time to run back and forth to the casinos to bet daily things. I enjoy finding a situation. I'll even tell a customer, one year a customer, I was walking the dogs, believe it or not, walking, we have two dogs in the store, walking the dogs, and somebody said, who do you like in the Derby? And according to the dosage I had, I gave him three horses. And I figured he's going to bet $10. He was just kidding. He bet $750 on this horse. And the odds were 12 to 1. I'm not sure what year it was, but what year did Spend a Buck win the Kentucky Derby? About 1982, 83,
something like that.
This happened. I'm in it. I read. If you read and you absorb and you synthesize information and you fine-tune and you wait for your spot, you can make a profit. I'm ahead. I hope the IRS isn't listening. I'm ahead $1,400 for 14 years. That's $100 a year. That's $2 a week. I am ahead.
You read everything.
I read everything I can. Not all of it is applicable to betting, but I'm a generalist. I love to read and talk. I can talk to people about a variety of subjects, my newspaper background, my college background. I'll give you another example of something wild that happened to me in college. In Colorado, I went out and bought a greyhound. I was so interested in greyhound racing. I love greyhound racing. Anyway, about that time, I started to observe some sort of a numerical imbalance in the way certain results were coming in at the track. I couldn't figure out what it was. And for about 3 weeks, I clocked it. I mean, I wrote the numbers down, and I had somebody in the business department check these things. And he said, yeah, you're right. These numbers are coming out way out of proportion of what they should be. So I went to the track. I threw the program away for 3 weeks. This is not scientific at all. This is a gut instinct. I bet the 1-4-8 every race, except two or three of them, because they were long-distance races or really
some
bad races.
Some other parameter, yeah.
I only had about $54 bankroll every night, about 9 or 10 races. And every night, I hit one of those. It wasn't exactly 1-4-8. I was boxing, which is a combination. For $6, any combination of 1-4-8. First night, I hit for about 125. The second night, I hit for 300. I split whatever the trifecta was because I wasn't, without getting technical. Over a period of 21 days, I made $1,700. But I couldn't go on this for the rest of my life, running out to the track and betting automatically. My God, I wish they'd let me.
What do you think it was?
I think the track was running true and I caught something at the right time. I think, without getting into details on greyhound racing, when the one was running true, it knocked out the two and three. When the four was running down the middle, it knocked out the five and six. And when the eight slashed across, it disrupted the six and seven. It only had to happen once for a winner. But it happened for 3 weeks. And then after a while, I think the track discovered what was happening too. I can't prove what the track might have done to do something to the track, but all of a sudden, 1-4 eights weren't running anymore that well. It was 6-7-5, 5, whatever. But somebody else was noticing as well, because casinos have computers that will notice if a wheel's out of balance. Casinos have surveillance to see if a person's winning too much because they think they're doing something with a very sharp player. And just like anything else at a track, the horse players are observant as management, and they can see certain things happening. And then it stopped. It was like a little dream. And I made my money, and I proved my point, and information and instinct came through for me. And I think anybody can do that out there. But it is not easy work. Some of the people who are betting would be better off getting a job for $10 or $20 an hour, because at the end of the year, they're making the time and energy they put into this, which is sometimes sloppy and sometimes not, they might as well have had a job and used gambling as a hobby rather than gambling as a profession and a job as a hobby. People get it backwards sometimes.
Uh-huh.
And this town can turn people around sometimes. As people who are supposed to be paying attention to their job can't wait for the results or can't wait to make a bet or can't wait for the line to move. It's like the stock market here with sports betting. You get really twisted out of shape. So you must maintain control here. You are like a person who loves to eat working in a pizza parlor. You must maintain control because you can, if you only bet $10 a day, for a whole year, what does that add up to be? If you lose $10 a day, that's a lot of...
$36, $37.
You can buy yourself something nice with that. I always try, when I win big on anything, buy something right away, whether it be a pair of shoes or records or whatever. But do something. There are a lot of people, I'd say 6 to 8% of the population is in trouble.
they can't control themselves. Nobody knows
it's
how many.
It's about that.
It's somewhere in that range. It may be going
once
up.
They start, they can't stop.
Yeah.
Just visit one of the local casinos, what we call the local casinos. There's 7 more being built in town just for the locals.
Just and for the people
see,
who
and they're
live
crowded
here.
Every single night, Monday through Sunday, just packed. Just locals, yeah, strip people with
now, how do you
tourists
know that they're locals? I mean, they don't have the big signs.
Because
they don't,
tourists wouldn't go there. They're off the strip, and they wouldn't even know how to find them and things. They're in, like, my neighborhood where I live. And
they look like a bar or something.
No, they're big casinos. They're big casinos.
Really?
Yeah, and there's 7 more being built right now. So, and they're all jammed. It's an amazing phenomenon. So the
and
people that live here play, let me tell
now,
you.
Now, what do they play? Do they play the same thing the tourists do?
Well, they could play bingo. They could play cards. A lot of retirees are bored. And they have a Social Security check. I mean, the smart ones will if put some money away. They play sessions. A session is where you say, I'm going to play for a few hours, and if I lose my $10 or $20, I'm going to quit. If I double my money, I'll leave. And that takes a lot of discipline. Others become somewhat addicted. There are bingo addicts. There are keno addicts. There are poker fanatics. There are sports betting addicts and horse playing addicts. The worst are the crapshooters. The worst. I'll give you another story. We have a customer, I will not use his name, I hope he's not listening, he's 82 years old, one of the sharpest minds I've ever seen, he's very street smart. I've met very few people as sharp as this man. He could take a small check and run it up, like in the movies, it's a miracle. He won in 3 days $800,000 in craps. Now I'll give you an example, he had no control. Within 72 hours, he had lost the $800,000 plus another $5,000. But he has the ability to come back like the ashes of Phoenix. At any time, he's really not in great physical shape now, but if he could crawl to a casino, he'd be at a crap table right now shooting those dice. It's addictive. It's something that he does very well. He has an instinct knowing when the odds are right or the table's running hot or whatever, and he can do it. There are other people out there doing that now. I said to him, why did you lose the $800,000? He says he always wanted to win $1 million. I said, you could have lied. Nobody would have known the difference.
Couldn't you add it to the last
you put it in the bank for
grand.
A couple of years, you'll have your $1 million, you know, or do something with it, you know, invest in something.
But he couldn't, like, have it start to go down and stop.
No, it was there. It's there. It's like a guy who loves to eat and sees a big meatloaf. He's got to have it all. I keep equating it to food, but I think gambling and eating, or maybe there's a correlation
pretty
in sex,
close.
Too.
You're listening to Tech Nation Live from Las Vegas, Nevada, and the 1994 Network World Plus Interop Conference. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guests today are Howard Schwartz, Marketing Director for the Gamblers Book Club and Bookshop, and Jim Bale from SportsStat. Okay, Jim, what's the largest bet you ever made? Come on.
Just my own money or a group of people?
Oh, keep speaking.
Oh, when I was a youngster in living near Saratoga again, we used to live... I used to park cars for the best restaurant in the area, so all the trainers that would come up to fashionable Saratoga, I knew the trainers, and the guys would always let me take care of the guy on the way out, and if it was a big trainer, and he'd have $1 or $2 tip for us in a hand, I'd say, excuse me, Mr. Jerkins, or whoever it was, we'd rather have a horse going tomorrow. So this guy gave us a winner 3 years in a row. Then the fourth year, we decided we saved all summer for him when he came up. And we waited and waited and waited. Towards the end of August, he finally showed up, and he came out, and he said, I got one just as good as the others. And he said, it's called Hasty Hitter. So he's going tomorrow. And I took the day off. We went in every waitress and busboy in the restaurant. It was a big resort. And all the parking lots and everything, and parking lot attendants. I think I brought down, I took the bets, about $8,400 on this horse. And everything. And he broke his leg in the starting gate before he got out.
So this guy never got another plate of food, another drink?
No, I think he was destroyed, actually, on the track right shortly after that. But
oh, boy.
That's the biggest bet I made. It's hard to win your big ones for some reason. If you're a $100 better and you decide all of a sudden, oh, it's the Derby, I'm going to bet $500, it's a kiss of death. It's very tough to win your big one.
You know, it is funny. So many times, I mean, it's true in so many areas, not just gambling. It's like you get really fixated and you're saying, oh, I'm really going to work hard, I'm going to make this happen. And you go, and you say... I didn't get much result for everything I put in it. Then you're going along just doing stuff, and you get some major results. So there's a pattern here. When was the most you ever won?
I think I won $2,400. I don't play the crazy stuff like the pick sixes and things that pay $250,000 and things like that. Just because I believe it takes such a huge bankroll, and I don't like long losing streaks either. But I think the best day I ever had was I went 8-for-9 at Belmont one day. I had 8 out of 9 winners, and I think I won about $2,400. The problem is you don't know when it's going to come. You know, it would be great if you at the first race you knew you were going to win the next 8 straight. You know, but I think that was my best day.
$2,400. How about you, Howard?
The most I ever bet in my life was $77, and I lost that bet in sports betting. The most I've ever won was $1,700 at Greyhound Racing on one ticket, on one race, and it was by pure accident. It was not even skill, and I confess to that. I looked at my binoculars, and the binoculars said 7X35. I bet the binoculars. I bet $2. The second best thing I ever did was a thoroughbred horse by the name of Sonny's Halo, a Canadian horse. At the time, I was doing 2 gambling magazines, and I saw this and was subscribing to a newspaper clip service, which is very valuable for anybody researching. I saw that this horse had won a very big Canadian race, and it was injured. It was just about March, and they were sending it to California for hydrotherapy. I think they put it in the swimming pool.
The horse in the swimming pool.
Yes,
the
horse.
Yes, the horse.
Yeah, it's like acupuncture or anything else. And my hunch was that they were thinking that much of sending this Canadian horse to California, he might be worth a bet. So I looked on the sheets, and it was 100-1. Now, I waited 2 days to think about it. I was going to bet big bucks for me.
Big
Howard bucks. 5 to win, 5 to place, 5 to show. In those days, at some of these hotels, they would take win, place, and show. While I was waiting for the 2 days, a trainer flew in from California and bet $300 at 100-1 at 2 places, knocked the price down to 50-1, so that's all I could get. I still bet my 5 to win, 5 to place, won the Kentucky Derby that year. I was so excited, I mean, I almost passed out. I mean, it just, I won $450 on 50, but I think the reason I was so excited is that I did it on my own. You know, I found a way of winning that, but it's only my theory. This is the Schwartz theory of gambling, which has never been published
anywhere.
Very
scientific. We like that. Now, when I walked through the sports book, there was a whole bunch of guys standing at these desks, and they had little things so that you could kind of lean back and talk to each other. But when you had your papers, nobody could kind of look across. It's like in school, no eyes on paper. And they had these sheets out, and everybody had all this. It's all very kind of neat. What are they looking at?
Those are the horse players. They're playing the 10 tracks that I was telling you about. And what they have laid out there is called the racing form, which is basically the Bible. One of the greatest monopolies in the country. So it's the only newspaper that covers racing. It's about the size of the New York Times. A new company in Northern California called Trackmaster has just come out with a little computer, and we're talking about technology, about twice the size of 2 packs of cigarettes, and it has as much or more than the racing form in it, and it's got a little screen, and you can download 2 or 3 tracks into it each day. And so it's interesting.
They load up who's there.
It does it automatically, 800 number and everything. It's fantastic. You know, you press 3 buttons and it downloads into this little computer, like I said, very small, maybe 4 by 6 inches. And it's got all the information that the dirty old, and you used to always make your hands dirty, you know, when you do research and stuff, your hands would be black after an hour. It's got all the information that the Bible has now for, had a monopoly on for the last 100 years. And it's a nice little convenient little machine.
I used to date a guy who used to impress girls by walking around with a racing form. Now, of course, I was in San Francisco, so you only had to buy one about once every 2 months.
A friend of mine that was divorced because of racing forms, because we all store them. I have 2 years in my garage built on special shelves I had built. But this guy actually got divorced because he had 7 years filling 2 rooms of his apartment, and his wife said, it's the forms, go or you go, and she said, bye.
That's easy.
Yeah.
Racing form, door. Yeah.
Well, that's before we had the databases. That's how we did our research on yellow pads and, with a year or two of racing forms.
Well, what's going to happen? Where are we going with all this technology? I mean, suddenly you're getting all this data.
Well, you'll probably be able to get out of bed in the morning, pick up the phone, and make your bets at the track and watch it on television and go back to sleep.
Pennsylvania's doing that now.
Who is?
Pennsylvania has it now, Telebet. The races are live on TV, and you can punch a bet. It's the first legalized gambling in the house. Punch a bet in right over the phone.
I don't know if that's the way to do it. I think I hate to see what's happening in paramutual betting, because the people who are running the tracks are such morons. Really, they are. They've lost touch with the players in reality, and I think what we're going to see is tracks with no people at them. I think they're going to run the horses, and we'll be able to bet by television or satellite, and people won't be going. Thus, the love of the sport of thoroughbred racing, of the bloodlines and the history and the smell and the tradition and whatever, and the color, will be lost to this new generation. I hate to see this happening. It's happening in greyhound racing also because the casinos are a fast-action type of a game, and that people do not want to wait 15 to 20 minutes between races to be actually at the track. If you're here in 15 minutes, you could be betting 15 races. I mean, that's a little crazy there, but I mean, that's an example. I think this generation, I hate to say the attention span shorter, this, that, but they're more impetuous. The patience isn't here. That's why your parimutuel betting is dying to a certain degree. Management is starting to come back. It's a little late. It's like starting, trying to turn the Lusitania around, or the Titanic before it hits the iceberg, the Titanic more likely. But it takes a while to turn, you know, 3 miles till you turn that ship around. But there may be soon a marriage between the casinos and the tracks. In other words, the track is there, but if it's only open for 60 or 90 days a year, what do you do with the other 9 months? Well, now you may see like what happened in Hollywood. We'll see, have a card room. We'll have a dance floor. We'll have rock concerts, utilizing the land and the
plant. Well, a lot of racetracks have golf courses in the middle. That's when I go to the racetrack.
I think more diversity and I think a little more insight on the part of management would have helped this whole situation many years ago. Management, in many cases, parimutuel, does not listen. They are mahogany heads. They should be listening to the players. They should be getting out of their ivory towers and getting down and mixing with the $2 bettors and say, what do you want? What don't you like? The track should have invited the people with computers years ago to have a special section of the track to plug in their computers and to have a special room where they could play with their databases and whatever. They made the people who had computers so uncomfortable and so unhappy. And they still do that. I mean, why can't a person bring a computer into a casino to bet sports?
They can't do that?
So it depends on the place, right, Howard?
Well,
each casino has its own.
They're hassling people with cellular phones now because they're shopping and they're afraid of interstate violations and people.
You can't tell what they're doing on the phone.
Well, things like that. But let people have fun. Give them the least amount of static, and this is what it's supposed to be. And if the tracks would have listened a long time ago to certain things, listen to the players and listen, unless they're listening to their own management who are just repeating what they've done before. That's why big companies are going by the wayside now. They lost touch with what's really going on in the world.
You know, and from a racetrack point of view, there's no reason you can't go to any single racetrack and not have the same setup you have here where you're seeing all the other racetracks.
That's the simulcasting, is basically what you're talking about. That's going to, if the industry is going to be saved, that's what's going to save it. In the next 2 years, we should know. Certain states, though, one of the problems is every state has its own regulations. It's controlled by the states. But every state, not every state, about half the states still have their heads buried in the sand. And I remember just recently the director of the NYRA, New York Racing Association, said, they simulcasted races for the first time this winter. They took 5 races a day from Florida, and he said it was terrible, and his customers hated it and everything. Now, I have 150 subscribers at least from New York, and about 20 of them I spoke to, and every one of them said it was the greatest thing that's ever happened to racing in New York. Right, because it gives them more choice, you know, 15 races a day instead of just 9. They don't have to play the bad races. They're not locked into the lousy New York cold winter product. They have the good, sunny, you know, Florida product. Just what Howard was saying. They have their heads buried in the sand, and they really need some people to come shake them up and start listening to the people and see what they want.
Gambling's been a vice, according to the high mucky mucks, the ones in the $400 suits who have the 26 IQ, who somehow got used into their jobs. I don't know where they get some of these people. Studies will show you one thing, but people don't want to go to tracks for a variety of reasons. Lousy parking, lousy traffic control, dirty tracks, overpriced food, pay for the seating and everything. By the time you get in there, it's your $20 in the hole before you sit down. Mm-hmm. See, and this is the same thing's going to happen to professional sports if they don't watch it. I mean, you take a family anywhere nowadays, it's $200. Let people have some fun, for God's sakes. Don't make them take a loan out to I don't want to become a stockholder with the track before I sit down. I want to have some fun. The track is taking 18 to 26% out. We found tracks. There are tracks in Puerto Rico, there was a dog track off the coast of Venezuela that was taking 40% out of every dollar before they even bet. I said, why don't you just put a gun to their ribs and rob them before they get on the boat going out to the track? Been much easier and a little,
You know it's going out.
That's horrible. People should know what the house edge is or what they're taking out of the investment going in. Uh-huh. Caveat emptor in anything you do in this world. And educating yourself is your own responsibility. I've seen people making bets at the crap table. They're unbelievable. I don't know what they're doing over there.
I never understood crap. That was it. Now let me ask you, Jim, how many people subscribe to the sports stats, and how much does it cost, and who does it? Who, just people who go to the racetrack?
Well, we have about 350 subscribers nationwide. Our data is nationwide. We usually pull our data from about 10 different major circuits, and it's everyone. I have great stories and sad stories. I have people call me and say they're retiring. You know, can you recommend three or four things for me to read or get into? You know, because I want to do horse racing again. I haven't done it for 20 years, and I tell them, geez, could you pick another field? I mean, you're starting with a 20% takeout, and it's a tough, tough game. You know, could you pick sports, or could you pick, you know, the stock market or something else? But if they really want to get into it, I'll recommend a couple of books from Howard Storr, or, you know, a software program or two. And it's a learning process.
Books do save you an enormous amount of time. Books inform you, and they are time savers. Mm-hmm. We know there are people sitting in different parts of the country right now with light on in a basement, digging out statistics hour after hour, which has already been compiled on the last 10 years of point spreads in football, the best strategy for blackjack, the systematic, which system works or doesn't work and why. And there are people creating these things to give people false hope. But what he does is he takes 10,000 or 20,000 races, and he says, this is how often you can expect something to happen. And so you can make a judgment based on that. Is it going to happen again? Who's to know? But you can see a certain statistic out of balance. You might want to say, hey, I think I've discovered something. That combined
That's
with my regular edge. Handicapping technique, hey, this is a missing bit of information, a missing link or a missing bit of data, I'm going to try that. I'm grafting on to my present form of handicapping. It's something exciting. It's something new. And you don't have to sit there for thousands of races or read hundreds of hours at the racing form looking for these things.
Uh-huh.
And you often, one more caveat for the listeners. If somebody says to you, I'm going to sell you a system that's going to make you $100 a day or $5,000 a year or guarantee you an income for life, do not believe them. There are people who are doing what they call peak picking, P-E-A-K picking. This is the most notorious form of system creating known to mankind, insidious. People in prisons can do this. They have plenty of time. They find the result and develop a system based on that. They back into it,
uh-huh.
You see? And then they're showing you how wonderful it is when you see this and see that. You could wait forever for these things to happen. It doesn't happen. They've backfitted it.
Uh-huh. You know, I want to ask you guys because we have a few minutes here. In calling all these people to get guest line up for the show this week, I was really amazed. Everybody I talked to in Vegas is smart, and they talk fast, and they're present and all that. But the one thing that absolutely killed me is no matter who I talked to, they'd say, this isn't before noon, is it? It's like, you guys are standard businessmen. What are your lives like? Nobody wanted to do anything before noon.
Well, I'm still single. I'm 54 and looking for a woman who can cook meatloaf and does not weigh me out, talk me out, eat me. All right, there's your pitch. No, it must take a very patient woman to put up with the guys in this town who come home from a hard day at God only knows what at 3 a.m. or whatever. A lot of divorces in this town. The women can't put up with this stuff. It really takes a lot out of the home life.
So you two are available.
I am.
Well, you know, I like my mobility and my flexibility. I go to sleep at 4 a.m. Get up at noon. We have a book, by the way. Play poker, quit work, and sleep till noon.
I like it, gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From the 1994 NetWorld plus Interrupt conference in Las Vegas, my guests have been Howard Schwartz, marketing director of the Gambler's Book Club and Bookshop, and Jim Bale, president of SportsStat. Additional thanks to Internet Multicasting Service and the Internet Showcase for providing facilities for this special program. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.